Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Cousby.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermentable.
Archived on iTunes, Stitcher, and right here at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Mary, what's going on?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to mention that we went to an absolutely fantastic event that was put on by Zach Shulman, called Ferment Ferment. It was the seventh annual Ferment Ferment event. It was at the Brooklyn Free School yesterday in Brooklyn, New York. And it was a free event. I think donations were taken. But the public was invited to bring whatever you've been fermenting and cultures to swap. There were a couple workshops.
It was a giant fermentation potluck with flavors abound of fermented everything. It was pretty fun, pretty awesome, and really interesting people.
Yep. We had a lot of kimchi. We had a delicious cashew cheesecake.
And a band called The Live Cultures. Which was super appropriate. The Live Cultures. I love it.
But that was an amazing time, so that won't happen again for a year unless we can convince Zach to make this a biannual event. The other thing that we did yesterday is that we poured our own homebrew at the pop-up brew pub at the Food Book Fair at the Wythe Hotel yesterday. So that was also a lot of fun. There were 25 different homebrews. I think a couple people made multiple beers, so I feel like there's around 22 different homebrewers. And that was Eric Steen, who we had as a call-in guest on our show a couple weeks ago. So that absolutely went off beautifully. There was such a great variety of beers, and the quality was extremely good and super interesting stuff. There was one of my favorites was, this is a polarizer though, I gotta say, was a beet Kolsch.
Yeah.
That was done by a guy named Chris. And
tasted like beets.
Yep.
So if you like beets, you probably would like that beer.
I like this beer, but there were some people that were not so hip on it, beet beer. But that was very well executed, and I thought it was a wonderful beer. There was a lot of really good beers.
Both events reiterated my fondness for people who ferment. They tend to be my favorite people. Pretty amazing.
It's true. Also, we poured one of my newer 1.75 gallon kegs that I recently acquired. We poured a short mead. It was like a spiced raspberry rosehip kind of short mead. I actually don't remember exactly what was in it. I've had it in the cooler in a carboy for a long time. But that went over super well. Everybody, that was well received. So once again, proving that short mead is an ever popular drink that if you bring it to a party, you will be the popular person at the party.
But that was yesterday.
That was yesterday.
What are the next things coming up? What's coming up?
Big Brew Day is this Saturday, so it's put on by the American Homebrewers Association and coordinated by them. There is, if you go to their website, there is a list of Big Brew Day locations. There's all kinds of club events, brew days happening in the backyards of individuals, of bars, at breweries.
You can go to homebrewersassociation.org to find out more information on the day itself and for events happening in your area, and also to join the American Homebrewers Association, which is well worth it, and it pays itself back in various discounts locally or afar if you're not local, wherever I am.
That's true.
What's going on? Oh, hey, what else is coming up this weekend? That same weekend, we are inviting John Palmer to New York City. He's going to be around doing a lot of different things, one of them being an American Homebrewers Association rally at our friend's place at Finback Brewing Company or Brewery on Sunday during the day. Also doing an appearance at Bitter and Esther's on Saturday. I'm not going in order here. I'm going to the 4th to the 3rd. And then back to the 4th because I'll be hosting him on Sunday night at 508 Gastro Brewery. And we would love it if anybody would like to join us for any or all of those happenings. And he will also be our guest on Ferment About It next week on Monday. He wrote the book, How to Brew. And you can find out more about that at howtobrew.com. But more recently, he wrote the book on water. So we're going to get very intense about water next week, and we're psyched about it. But today, what's happening, Mary?
Well, we're very excited to invite Chris Strait from Kombucha Brooklyn. Hi,
hello.
Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Thanks for joining us, man.
So I guess, I don't know where, I think I met you at Brewery Lane, maybe.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And then I visited Kombucha Brooklyn.
The happy hour,
the happy hour, which is the first Tuesday of every month from 5 to 7. Highly recommended. Tons of fun and just great beverages and company. And I always meet interesting new people. But Chris is... Chris, you're the official Scobie Rancher, or the Wrangler?
Wrangler, I believe.
Rancher, Wrangler, Farmer, Scobie, however you like to say it. Yeah, I wrangle them.
Well, we're going to pretend episode 3 didn't happen. If you want to know more about the basics of kombucha, you can hit our episode number 3, I think. But we're
as well as the episode with Jess, from Kombucha Brooklyn.
Yes, yes, yes. But what is a Scobie, and what is kombucha, really quick and briefly, and then we'll get to the gritty.
Real quick, the SCOBY is a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast that essentially metabolizes sugar and nutrients in tea, and basically the what's left over is this liquid that's kombucha, and it's pretty acidic is one of the major aspects of it. There are various acids created. It's lightly alcoholic, but very lightly. And it's refreshing. It's naturally effervescent. It's probably probiotic. As we'd like to say, it's good for the good. It's bad for the bad.
And how, so typically, just because you mentioned that it's lightly alcoholic, it's really lightly alcoholic, like typically your guys's.
Very lightly alcoholic. So as we have allies and bacteria in our bodies, we also have allies and bacteria in kombucha, because they're what actually keeps the alcohol level of kombucha at a level that doesn't necessarily raise really high eyebrows. It slightly raises the eyebrows, but it's a very low amount of alcohol generally, unless you want to send it into secondary fermentation where you can actually greatly increase the amount of alcohol in that kombucha.
And we're going to talk about that at the end, I think. So, but kombucha is typically below 1%.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So you guys also, it should be worth noting that you guys both have bottles and you do draft kombucha as well, which I think is awesome.
Absolutely. So one of the kind of things about kombucha is that we want to be, you know, as sustainable as possible. And so our kombucha on tap program, or our booch on tap program, has been really great, because you can refill vessels at a ton of different locations in the city and in Brooklyn. Brewery Lane is one of them. Hops and Hawks down the road. There's a ton of different places.
Yeah, Tap Room, so, 307 in Manhattan. They always have your guys' stuff.
Right, right. So all over. And then we also, of course, have bottles so that we can kind of get out of the city area, out of the tri-state or however many states we're around area, so we can get kombucha into as many hands as possible.
How much kombucha are you currently making?
Exact numbers, I'm not exactly positive of, but we have a massive keg program and as well as a bottling program. So we have a lot of booch out there.
What does that mean for you as a Scobie rancher or wrangler?
As a Scobie rancher, what that means for me is a lot more, you know, essentially a lot more awareness for the brand, which leads to me needing to produce a lot more Scobies for our homebrew kits, which is what we do through kombuchabrooklyn.com. We sell not only homebrew kits and cultures, but also brewing supplies, literature on fermentation, kombucha, just pretty much anything that you would want in your homebrewing escapades. We've got at kombuchabrooklyn.com. So,
you guys do good give classes at
absolutely
your,
so
your
yeah
location too.
About 4 times a month I teach kombucha classes. It's kombucha 101, and we have a lot of fun. We taste kombucha, we talk about the history of fermentation of tea, we drink tea and kombucha, and just give a basic overview of those histories, and then also, of course, how to brew your own kombucha.
Cool.
Let's talk more about tea.
Yeah.
Let's talk about tea. Yeah.
Well, basic tea for kombucha is what tea? Is there a general one that's just commonly accepted as the basic?
Absolutely. The commonly, you know, accepted tea for brewing kombucha is black tea, which, you know, can mean a lot of different things. There are a lot of different varieties of black tea, whether it be from the varietal or the region that it's grown or the level of oxidization, in terms of the level of oxidization, not only black tea, but also other teas that you can brew with. But the best food, really, as we like to say, for kombucha is and has been known to be pretty much just black teas. And so that's not, of course, the only tea that you can make kombucha with. You can go all out.
Yeah, because you recommend, because you guys, well, you do your kombucha with all kinds of teas.
Absolutely.
And I know that you've recommended, well, I've had some of yours that have contained pu'er, green tea, white tea, like
Yeah, we love experimenting with pu'erh, with oolongs. Green tea and white tea kombuchas are very nice and light. And when they're sort of effervescent, they're just really sharp and delightful as kombuchas. So there's a really broad spectrum of actual teas that you can use, Camellia sinensis. But not only those, you can also actually use herbs and spices to an extent in your kombucha brews.
How much does it affect the performance of the SCOBY flipping teas?
It absolutely, you know, it can be very drastic. So if you look at fermenting with just a black tea versus fermenting with something that, you know, not only might have a different nutrient profile, but also have a different kind of way to best extract all the nutrients and the flavors out of the teas, you might have an oolong that's sitting and fermenting for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and it's still not complete after 3 weeks. Whereas with a black tea generally, or especially as we've found with pu'erh teas, the culture is ravenous for these varieties of teas. So it really runs the gamut between, you know, not highly fermentable by kombucha culture and very highly fermentable by kombucha culture. So there's just so much tea out there. There's still a lot of experimentation and research to be done, but there absolutely is a broad spectrum of fermentability among teas.
And then when you're dealing with SCOBYs, how much will a SCOBY change when it goes to a different or a drastically different tea? Can you go back to a normal tea? Do you have to retrain your SCOBY? How do you wrangle it to use again?
Well, the SCOBY is actually, it's pretty resilient. It will accept pretty much any tea. You know, if you ferment 1 week or 2 weeks with a black tea, you can pretty easily go from using a black tea into using a green tea or a white tea or any of the other varieties of teas. Because really, you know, even when we farm our SCOBYs for people to brew at home with, we use a blend of black, green, and white teas. But that's not to say that when you get the SCOBY, you don't have to just use a blend of black, green, and white teas. It's going to be able to, as I said, run the gamut of all the different types of teas pretty well, and it's very very ready to change, and it's happy with new teas, it's happy with the same teas, so it's a very flexible culture.
So let's talk about what is pu'erh tea. We've talked about pu'erh tea on here a little bit, but since you mentioned that's one of the fastest teas for kombucha, and that's something that I think not as Americans we're not all very familiar with.
It is. Kombucha ferments pu'erh teas very quickly, and pu'erh is a style of tea that is intentionally aged or matured so that it elicits some different flavor characteristics. So early on when tea was, you know, first starting to be traded outside of China, they would have to, or even within China, they would have to transport it long distances. And in order to keep it from spoiling, they would essentially pound it into cakes. And then they found that as the pu'erh cakes would travel on, you know, horseback or the backs of camels, the flavor kind of started to change. And so, you know, when you have something that is exposed to moisture, it's going to definitely change with time, especially in terms of, you know, breaking it down, kind of fermenting, actually starting to decompose slightly. And so that is an aspect of pu'erhs that was definitely kind of seized upon. And it was found that these teas were highly medicinal and had a lot of different characteristics in terms of their flavor profiles. So, you know, whereas, you know, lots of other teas like oolongs or green teas can be relatively laborious or highly processed. And I'm not saying like highly processed by necessarily machines, but by hand. Like there's actually like, you know, techniques that go into doing it. And they elicit a broad spectrum of flavors, those teas definitely. But with pu'erhs, it's actually relatively simple, the processing of them. And most of the flavor depends on where the tea was grown, the environment that it was grown in, and how much wind there is, how much water there is, you know, if it's, you know, growing at high elevation or low elevation, definitely affects it. But, you know, most importantly, it's that aging process. And so it's the easiest tea to produce, but really the one of the most difficult teas to describe because a lot of times, you know, you have flavors that are elicited like decaying leaves or bark or mud.
Yeah, it's a very earthy.
Absolutely. It's earthy, and it can even range from, you know, depending on, you know, what type of leaf you've used for it. You can get really like muscat grape flavors or apricot flavors. So it really has a broad spectrum of flavors that can be elicited, and it's a really fascinating tea to work with.
I feel like that's something for people that might be listening to us that are experienced kombucha, you know, have been making some kombucha for a while, but maybe they haven't experimented with teas. that would be a great tea to add to their regimen, or at least try.
Absolutely.
And where I know you guys sell Pu'er, correct?
Yes, we do.
So people can order through your website. Otherwise, I mean, it's a little bit hard to get, I think, if you're, I mean, obviously in New York City with our Chinatowns, it's very easy to get.
Yeah.
And then I can always come to your place. But for those out there, you would probably, I think a lot of people that are in, you know, more rural areas or outside of an urban area, that they would have to order it. But it would definitely be worth it. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. And then let's talk a little bit about the effects of, well, we're going to have to go to break in about a minute, but let's just touch on kind of what is this combination of black, white, and green give to the tea?
So the combination idea, it was something that Kombucha Brooklyn has pushed for a long time by, you know, our founder, Eric Childs. He devised a blend of black, green, and white teas that is, you know, it basically allows you to get a really good sense of what kombucha can do without being like, if you were to just use a black tea, overly malty, or if you were just using a white tea, it might take a little bit longer to ferment and it might only have, you know, a certain aspect of like peaches or stone fruit, or with green tea, like a minerality or even like a grassy or vegetal flavor. So combining all of those different things into one kombucha brew really gives you a great basis to kind of say, you know, to yourself when you brew with it, hey, this can go, you know, many different ways. I really like the blend of this, but I really wonder if I kind of deconstructed, if I were to use, you know, single varietal teas or teas from different regions, black or just a black green black tea or white tea or a green tea. It's kind of a great foot in the door to kind of allow people to think a little bit further to the next level, and that's what I think is great about having a blend of black, green, and white tea. Not only that, but you know, there's a lot of flavors that, you know, put together in that tea.
Right, so it gives it a lot of depth.
Great depth, and it's very rounded flavor. Yeah, cool. Essentially.
With that, we're going to take a quick break. Thanks for listening to For Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to For Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. It is Monday, May, what day is it? It's the 27th of April.
April 28th. You're so close with these dates, but not quite right.
Very busy. Anyway, we're in the studio talking kombucha with our friend Chris.
From Kombucha Brooklyn. He just poured us some of your straight up kombucha, which has the black, green, and white tea blend.
Yep.
Delicious.
I don't know what day it is. Don't look at me.
So let's talk a little bit about, because you do a lot. I mean, so we were just talking about, you also brought a jasmine tea, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. A jasmine green tea kombucha. Mm-hmm.
And that will have like a more, you know, floral, perfumey kind of aspect. I know I've had that before. What are some of the other teas? What about using herbal or spice teas? Like, I have a friend who's been making kombucha with chai teas.
You can absolutely do that. You know, something that I try and stay away from when I'm talking to people who are new to brewing is recommending that they really go out on a limb with spices or herbs, because, you know, kombucha is still relatively, the brewing of kombucha at the home is still relatively, you know, relatively unexplored, I would say, and a lot of herbs or spices can possibly impart some unwanted aspects to your culture, especially what we want to avoid is volatile oils. So if you are brewing with something that's very high in volatile oils and it's able to contribute enough of those oils to your brew before you actually let it ferment, that oil can rise to the surface of your brew and it can cause the SCOBY's fermentation, or the creation of a SCOBY, which is actually a layer of cellulose on top of the nutrient blend. It can keep that from forming, and so then you run the risk, if that's not forming, it's not creating also acids that are going to keep bad things from growing in your kombucha.
Right. That makes sense. So what do you recommend if people want to explore, you know, they might have be beginner kombucha makers or they've had some experience, but they haven't really explored other herbal types of tea. So what would you recommend for somebody that wants to try, you know, some of these different tea blends or herbs or spices?
And you have to define tea because chamomile tea is really just an herb. It's not necessarily tea. So
So absolutely. Chamomile is not necessarily a tea. You could call it a tisane or an herbal tea. But when I talk about tea for kombucha, I really just mean Camellia sinensis, because that's the, you know, the tried and true, the traditional way to have created kombucha. Not to say that people haven't made it from other things, and you absolutely can, but the traditional original food, or as far as we know, has been Camellia sinensis. And if you want to start brewing with, you know, new herbs and things like that, you want to definitely start on the side, err on the side of caution. So you want to make sure that most of the nutrient that you're using, if you're using a, you know, a set amount of tea for a gallon of kombucha, say, you want to make sure that a majority of that is going to be actual tea. And then beyond that, you can experiment with adding something like chamomile, which probably, you know, not probably, it definitely wouldn't take much chamomile to impart a really nice chamomile flavor to your kombucha. So, you know, if you're doing a 1 gallon brew, say, you know, 10 grams could be black tea, and then another 4 grams could be chamomile. So you want a majority of the flavoring to be, you know, kind of outside of the consideration of it being a nutrient for your kombucha. So.
Right, because teas have a lot of, I mean, the difference between basically herbs and spices and these herbal tea blends and actual Camellia sinensis is that the Camellia sinensis has nutrients that the SCOBY needs to use, in order to do its thing.
Mm-hmm. Is kombucha alive the whole way through? Does it stop fermenting? When you remove the SCOBY, is it still living? Is there still some SCOBY in suspension?
It is still living, absolutely. You know, you can take a culture and put it in the fridge and some already brewed kombucha with a lid on it and come back to it 6 years later, and you're still going to be able to start a kombucha brew from it. Similarly, you can also dehydrate kombucha brews. So a lot of some of the places online where you can get cultures, they sell them dehydrated. You know, I've talked to people that, you know, say that they've ordered those cultures and they'll try and get them started for a few weeks, and it just takes so long, and it's kind of reticent even to get started fermenting, but it's really best definitely to have a fresh piece of culture, and even one that's just been in the fridge, you know, dormant for a while can be a great way to start your brew. It's fine.
Cool. What would you do to revive a SCOBY that's been in your refrigerator for 6 years?
I would sing it lullabies. I might poke it a little bit, but definitely feed it a nice nutrient solution of tea. I would probably start with a black tea if it was a dehydrated kombucha culture, and sugar, and a little bit of either already brewed kombucha, which might impart some additional culture that you may or may not want. But really what you want when you're trying to revive a culture like that is going to be something that prevents mold from starting to grow. So something like vinegar. You want to use distilled or pasteurized vinegar for that.
Do types of sugar matter or affect flavor?
Absolutely. So, you know, common knowledge about kombucha is that you can, you know, pretty much use white sugar, like just the type of sugar you would see at a diner in the shaker for your coffee, but also organic evaporated cane sugar, which is what we brew with, but also things like honey. Honey, you know, contrary to popular belief, you can actually brew kombucha with honey, but you wouldn't want to use the same culture that, you know, you would with a black, green, or white tea and sugar, because with time the culture will begin to be killed off by the honey, and that we have a specific culture that feeds very well on honey, we found, and it feeds very well also on lighter teas. So that's a great way to have sustainable kombucha that's sweetened with something that's much more local, rather than getting your sugar from like Panama or some place where, you know, it comes a very, very long way in 50-pound bags to get to you. So it's a great option for, you know, people that are into kind of the local sustainability movement, but also people that are looking to, you know, reduce their allergies or have a really nice floral nature to their kombucha that is going to be imparted, you know, based upon the flowers that the bees have visited and brought back to their hive.
And it's called a June or a Jun?
We call it June. J-U-N, no E on the end. And it's absolutely spectacular. It's delicious.
And you said lighter teas, so white, like white and green teas typically?
White and green
teas. With honey.
Yeah, with honey. And, you know, just like the same ratio you use for baking. So per gallon, instead of 1 cup of sugar, which I would use 3/4 cup of honey. And then you can really start to experiment with quite a few different things. So one of my favorite blends for June is jasmine green tea and chamomile. And it makes stellar kombucha, and you're still left with the aromatics and the florality of the honey in the final brew. And also the June culture, it seems to resist turning to something that is almost unpalatably acidic. So yes, it will still be acidic, but it won't get strangely acidic, kind of like some standard kombucha cultures will after just feeding on, you know, white sugar and black tea. So it turns into more like a dry champagne. Than something that you wouldn't necessarily want to drink that you might reserve for salad dressing or something like that.
One of the reasons why I asked about whether it was still alive when you did, because you know, in beer or in mead making, we'll sometimes do some back sweetening. Well, not so much in beer, but back sweetening. Does that happen in kombucha to balance out flavors, or would it make vessels explode, and would that sugar be eaten?
So before you bottle it, you really want to consider how much sugar is in your kombucha when you're bottling it, because that is still going to be potentially fermentable sugars for the culture to continue to feed on. So if you take the SCOBY off, the liquid in there is still going to have bits of the culture. It's not going to be nearly as concentrated, but there's still yeast and bacteria in there that will continue to feed on the nutrients in tea as well as the sugar, the sweetener that you have in it. So that's, you know, that's one of the considerations that, you know, all kombucha brewers have when they're bottling. is the carbonation that's going to be created, and you don't want your bottles exploding on shelves, of course. You know, not only exploding, but also increasing beyond the legal alcohol limit, which is 0.5% in the United States.
So is it a practice that's done? It's not, because it would be dangerous. You're back sweetening. It's like, so typically, a characteristic of kombucha is relatively dry. Like a sweetened perception, but not an actual body.
Right. It's more dangerous, definitely, with kombucha. So the kind of the aspect of like priming sugar for a beer when you're bottling or something like that, you can definitely do that with kombucha, but you really need to keep track and be aware of that you have added that to it, and you need to pay a little extra attention to the CO2 that you're potentially creating in the bottle. And so when people are bottling their kombucha and generally letting it sit at room temperature for secondary fermentation so it can become effervescent, you might consider, you know, bottling also in a plastic vessel so that you can be sure that your, you know, your glass bottles don't explode.
So you kind of know by...
Right, just how
feeling the plastic, yeah,
absolutely
tension,
yeah.
What? So talking. Let's. So on the same subject. Last time I was at Kombucha Brooklyn for a happy hour, you had a couple of homebrewed alcoholic kombuchas,
yes,
that you shared, and then actually a guy who had taken one of your classes came in with 2 kombucha wines.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how if people are making a lot of kombucha, maybe they don't. You know, they're not drinking it, or they, you know, drinking it enough, or they want to do an alcoholic kombucha.
And so defining alcoholic is, if 0.5 is the legal version, so is 1% considered alcoholic?
Yeah, but...
Or where are we calling the term?
These are more, I mean, you can get up to, I mean, 10%, right? You can get pretty high.
Potentially, yeah, you can get pretty high, and there are some alcoholic kombuchas out there on the market as well that get up pretty high. But as far as I'm concerned, I want to, you know, try and reserve... you know, some nature, some characteristic of that kombucha in the final brew, even if it's a little bit higher alcohol. So really it wasn't done to make something that, you know, would knock my socks off in terms of alcohol, but I wanted to make something that was delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the last happy hour, what I had was, we had 3 different types of kombucha wines that I made, which basically you brew up a kombucha and then you, pitch yeast into it, actually champagne yeast. And a few of them, I didn't pasteurize them before I pitched the yeast in there. So you still have, you know, good or not bacteria and yeast in there with the champagne yeast. And I also pitched in some additional nutrient in the form of either pomegranate concentrate or Concord grape concentrate, as well as some more sugar. And then I put that under an airlock and let it sit until basically the airlock seemed to have nothing left. And then that was the kombucha wine.
Cool. And what do you recommend as far as kind of percentages of, you know, sugar or nutrient, or do you have some kind of guidelines, I guess, for somebody that wants to start doing this?
You know, I don't. It's still really relatively uncharted territory mm-hmm. for me, but, you know, when I resweetened it after it was done fermenting, I threw in per gallon another cup of sugar. And I can't exactly remember how much of the fruit nutrient I used, but it was a concentrate, and I used definitely, you know, at least 6 ounces per gallon of that, just as some additional food for the yeast, mm-hmm. and a little bit of the flavor as well.
And you could probably also repitch sugar or some type of sugar or honey or, you know, anything, right, that would
definitely
feed the yeast. Something else that was interesting, so I cannot remember his name, the guy who came, but he had one that he made with black tea and then Earl Grey.
Yeah, he had a great Earl Grey kombucha.
Yeah, and they tasted so different. The other thing that I noticed, because I've had some of the commercial kombuchas on the market, but not really anyone that I've been able to talk to about it, is that it really changes the flavor. Actually, a lot of the acidity, I feel like the acidity actually goes away more somewhat, right? It's less acidic as a kombucha wine than straight kombucha,
right?
Which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it does kind of go away. The thing you want to be aware of, from my experience with kombucha wine though, also is letting it sit too long, because it does kind of get strange and barnyardy if you're not if you don't have some, you know, wizardry skills in kind of stabilizing that. You know, the fridge doesn't really work. It does still change a lot in the fridge to make it almost unpalatable, so it really much, much more readily caters itself to being consumed immediately mm-hmm. rather than after storage. Mm-hmm.
Is anybody barrel aging kombucha, and is that a good idea?
Barrel aging kombucha, I will go out on a limb and say it's not a good idea unless you've pasteurized it. So you might be able to pasteurize the kombucha, then pitch it into a barrel, but that's only because you don't want exploding barrels. You want to kill anything, you know, yeast in there that's going to potentially contribute a really strong effervescence that might actually, you know, be of detriment to, you know, the vessel that you're secondary fermenting in, like a barrel.
Right.
So you'd have to keep that in mind. I haven't done it yet, but it's on the list.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yet. I like that yet action.
And that is our show for tonight.
Thanks for listening to Ferment About It on HeartTree.
Yeah, thanks to Chris Strait from Kombucha Brooklyn on all his... Now I know a lot more about teas than I did before. So I hope that you guys are inspired, for those of you that are kombucha makers out there, that you're inspired to try some new teas and maybe a little bit of June. You can purchase the June Cultures as well at Kombucha Brooklyn, right?
That's right.
.com. And have fun. Ferment happy.
Happy brewing.
Happy brewing. Ferment.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.